Department of Labor and Industries.
May it please the Court, Steve Vineyard, Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Labor and Industries. I'd like 3 minutes for rebuttal.
You're welcome.
Because Mr. Miller's employer was not making payments for health care benefits on his behalf at the time of his injury, health care benefits cannot be included in the calculation of his wages. The Superior Court erred when it concluded that health care benefits should be included in his wage calculation for two reasons. First, under the plain language of the Industrial Insurance Act, a worker's wages are calculated based only on the wages being paid by the employer at the time of the injury, not future anticipated wages. Second, the case law, including Granger, fully supports this plain reading of the statute. This court should reverse. RCW 5108-178 provides that a worker's benefits are calculated based only on the wages received at the time of the injury, unless another statute specifically provides for a different outcome. No statute provides for using anticipated wages or future wages that were not being paid to the worker at the time of an injury. And RCW 5108-178 specifically discusses health care benefits, ties health care benefits to the payments being made by the employer, and specifically references the health care benefits being paid at the time of the injury. The statute unambiguously does not provide for the use of future wages. The case law, including Granger and Cockle, also reinforces that a worker's benefits under the Industrial Insurance Act are calculated based on the wages actually paid at the time of injury. And Cockle, which is the decision which initially ruled that health care benefits can be included in a wage calculation, expressly commented on the fact that the statute ties a worker's benefits to the wages received at the time of the injury. It stated that the worker in that case was receiving health care benefits at the time of the injury, and it was on that basis that the court concluded that those payments, those benefits, should be included. And the court specifically commented as well that in including health care benefits, we should use the amount actually paid by the employer at the time of the injury. And so under that analysis here, no amount was being paid for health care benefits at the time of the injury. So under Cockle, no amount for health care benefits can be included in the wage calculation. Granger, which the worker relies on, which Mr. Miller relies on, which the Superior Court relied on, does not point to a different outcome. And in fact, it supports the department's analysis. Granger involved a different factual situation where the employer was making payments for health care benefits on the worker's behalf at the time of the injury. But because there was a union worker and there was a banked hour system, the worker was not yet qualified to actually have health care coverage. So he could not go to group health or whoever the insurer was and have coverage. But payments were being made. And the court said that under the Industrial Insurance Act, as long as the employer is making payments, the worker is receiving those payments. And it was on that basis that the court said that the health care payments are included in the wage calculation. Here, there were no payments being made, and so under Granger, there's no basis for saying that Mr. Miller was receiving health care benefits at the time of the injury. And finally, I'll just touch on the issue of whether the court's use of this phrase, lost earning capacity, whether that justifies using future wages, and put simply, it does not. If you look at the cases that have used that term, lost earning capacity, including Cockle and Granger, what the case law shows is what the courts are referring to is this principle that under the Industrial Insurance Act, workers' benefits are calculated based on the wages actually received at the time of injury, not some sort of arbitrary figure. And what the courts were referring to was the fact that in a much older version of the statute, all workers got the same amount of time loss compensation, regardless of what they were making at the time of the injury. Then the legislature amended the statute to provide for using the wages received at the time of the injury. And that was based on this idea that that better captures the worker's lost earning capacity. In no way does that principle or that concept or that case law or that discussion support the idea that future wages not paid at the time of the injury can be included in a wage calculation. And so the Superior Court, quite simply, was incorrect when it ruled that either the statute or the case law support this outcome. And unless the court has a question for me, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Ryan Johnson for the respondent, James Miller. The relevant case law dictates that the true focus of the analysis of whether or not healthcare benefits should be included in the wage order is lost earning capacity, not eligibility at the time of injury or payments being made at the time of injury. As such, the Superior Court did not err when it reversed the decision of the board, and it should be affirmed. The Washington Supreme Court has repeatedly stated that the Industrial Insurance Act mandates that its provisions be liberally construed for the purposes of minimizing suffering and economic loss to workers who are injured in the course of employment, and thus, therefore, all doubts are to be resolved in favor of the injured worker. Accordingly, all relevant statutes and case law should be read with the purpose of minimizing such suffering and economic loss. Now, the department argues that 5108178 is unambiguous. However, this is not so. The Supreme Court in Granger was tasked with construing both the meaning of the language receiving at the time of injury and what constitutes consideration under the statute. The court would not have done so if the statute was unambiguous. Therefore, the court must apply the rule of liberal construction. Now, relevant case law supports the conclusion that Mr. Miller's expected health care benefits should be included in his wage order. First, Mr. Miller's expected benefits can constitute consideration of like nature under the statute. And second, the proper analysis for inclusion of health care benefits in a wage order focuses on the worker's lost earning capacity, not merely on eligibility or actual payment. Now, the purpose of including health care benefits in a wage order is to protect a worker's basic health and survival. In the Cockle case, the Supreme Court was asked for the first time to determine whether the value of employer-provided health care coverage should be included in a wage order. The court held that health care benefits should be included, stating that health care coverage is one of the core non-fringe benefits that must be included in consideration of wages under the statute.
The statute refers to employer's payment or contributions. Are you arguing that this should be included as a payment, or are you arguing that it should be included as a contribution?
I'm arguing that it should be included through a liberal construction of the statute, but between those two options, I would argue that it would be included as a contribution rather than a payment. So in the Cockle case, the court found that healthcare coverage was a substantial component of the workers' negotiated contract of hire, and emphasized that consideration of like nature includes benefits such as healthcare coverage that are readily identifiable and reasonably calculated in-kind components of a worker's lost earning capacity and are crucial to protecting the worker's basic health and survival. In this case, the stipulated facts show that just like in Cockle, the healthcare benefits that Mr. Miller was promised were a substantial component of his negotiated contract for hire with Shope Concrete and were one of the main reasons that Mr. Miller accepted the position. Mr. Miller's anticipated health care benefits were neither hypothetical nor remote nor set by some arbitrary standard. The Shope Employee Handbook clearly established that as a full-time employee, Mr. Miller would become eligible for health care upon the completion of a 90-day orientation period. Mr. Miller intended to work for Shope Concrete past that 90-day orientation period, and but for his industrial injury would have. Further, the fact that Shope continued to pay Mr. Miller a salary for 6 months after his injury likewise tends to establish that Shope likewise intended to retain Mr. Miller. Contrary to the department's arguments, the inclusion of health care benefits is not entirely contingent upon eligibility at the time of injury. Rather, when considering whether or not health care benefits should be included in a wage order, the primary concern of the analysis is on the injured worker's lost earning capacity. Here, Mr. Miller lost earning capacity as a result of the industrial injury includes the loss of his expected health care benefits. In Granger, the Supreme Court was asked to determine whether or not payments into a health care trust fund would be included in the work in the wage order in an instance where the worker had to bank time to gain eligibility. At the time of the injury, the worker did not have had not accumulated enough hours, and thus his health care benefits had lapsed. The court found that health care benefits should be a part of his earning capacity, and in making its ruling in Granger, the Supreme Court emphasized that the proper focus is on lost earning capacity. The court stated that when the worker was injured, he lost the ability to bank the requisite hours that would be required for him to gain eligibility, and thus it should be reflected in his time loss compensation. The court found that the injury prevented the worker from working the requisite hours and that he would have been eligible to receive those health care benefits but for his industrial injury.
But after Granger was decided, the legislature amended the statute to include health care benefits as a payment or contribution. So how does that affect your analysis?
I could be wrong, Judge Trickey, but it was my understanding that the statute was actually amended after Cockle and before Granger?
Yes, I think you're right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So,
sorry.
No, that's okay. You kind of threw me for a loop there for a second. So I think that adds to the argument that the statute had already been amended, and this was before the Granger court.
I guess I'm looping back to Judge Dwyer's question, though. Payment or contribution?
Okay.
Help me understand, what's the contribution? If it's not a payment, what's the contribution?
Well, I think that the proper focus is on the the negotiation at the time of hire, that these were expected benefits under the contract for hire. Although the court in Granger did note that it was persuaded by the worker's argument that he was receiving his health care benefits because his employer was making payments into the trust, the court repeatedly emphasized that the true focus was on the worker's lost earning capacity. Thus, to draw the conclusion that the employer must be making some payment somewhere in order for the benefit to be considered received under the statute ignores the court's greater objective of analyzing lost earning capacity. And Mr. Miller would have been eligible for health care benefits but for his injury, and therefore they should be included in his wage order.
But the employer in Granger was making contributions, right?
That is true. Further, policy requires that the expected health care benefits be included in Mr. Miller's wage order. Again, the act is to be liberally construed in favor of the injured worker for injuries occurring in the course of employment. Here, again, Mr. Miller was promised health care benefits under specifically defined conditions, and those benefits were a significant reason for him accepting the position. And he would have gained those benefits but for his injury. Now, the department's proposed reading of 5108.178 would allow employers to avoid paying such benefits to workers in situations such as in this case, simply by opting to have a 90-day or 120-day orientation period, rather than to use a trust fund such as in the Granger case. Now, this shift of power from the employee to the employer runs contrary to the underlying policy and purpose of the Industrial Insurance Act to protect injured workers against economic hardship. And both Cockle and Granger established that liberal construction of the act in favor of the worker is a statutory mandate, not a general statement of legislative purpose, as the department argued in its reply. Now, the department cited...
What would be measured to add to the compensation given?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, could you repeat that?
Well, let's say he was getting paid $10 an hour. There's a formula for when you're paid $10 an hour. Now what you're saying, we should get $10 an hour, whatever the formula would give him for $10 an hour, plus some amount for the health care benefits. And I'm saying, how would that be measured?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, the stipulated facts define the set amount that the employer was paying at that time for a worker.
So it's the amount paid to other people?
Yes.
Paid for other people?
Under the same circumstances. And if I might conclude really quickly.
Very quickly.
Very quickly. The department cited Gardner First Heritage Bank for the proposition that Mr. Miller's request for attorney's fees would fail because it did not have its own section under its brief. In that case, the request for fees failed not only because it was only in the conclusion, but also because there was no citation to any authority or argument.
All right.
Here there was a citation to argument. Accordingly, Mr. Okay. Miller respectfully right, requests. Thank you.
Mr. Vineyard, don't be upset by the fact that the motoring public appears to no longer have much interest in our labors here today.
For being the last on the docket. In fact, I think it's probably only that. But anyway, in rebuttal, I would just argue that under the plain language of the Industrial Insurance Act, workers' benefits are calculated based on the wages received at the time of the injury. The worker, Mr. Miller, argues that Granger stands for a broader proposition that lost earning capacity, and presumably in the sense of some sort of anticipated earnings, has to be taken into account. But if you read the Granger decision, nowhere does Granger adopt or embrace such a broad legal doctrine. What the court was concerned with was analyzing when a worker receives a benefit for the purposes of the statute, because that case presented...
I'm curious why your argument is something other than... There's no employer payment. There's no employer contribution. The statute requires one or the other. Thanks for coming. I'm done.
That is my argument, and then the case law is pointed just to say, and nothing in the case law changes that.
Okay.
So I do agree with Your Honor that the statute is dispositive. I don't think the term in the statute can be, I don't think the terms either payment or contribution can reasonably be interpreted in this situation to include an anticipation of future payments. It has to be, something has to be actually paid by the employer at the time of the injury.
And your argument be that what's different in Granger is Granger, there existed a contribution made by an employer.
Yes. That's exactly what distinguishes them and exactly why there should be a different outcome. Thank you. The department requests that the court reverse, and unless the court has any questions, I'll conclude.
All right. Thank you very much. And that concludes our